Lecture 18, The Witch Craze and Its Historians.
Welcome to Lecture 18. In Lecture 17, I began to, in a sense, create a context for the witch craze by examining religious and cultural developments. And what I would like to do here is to look at the social and economic developments and end the lecture with a discussion of torture and punishment and control in early modern Europe, and to, in a sense, tie this or relate this to the manner in which witches were executed, the kind of theatricality of power that is displayed in witch trials. I want to, in a sense, reiterate what I already said in lectures 2 and 3, which is, of course, that I firmly believe that all this cultural phenomena has to be embedded within a kind of social and economic and political and cultural and religious context. That is to say that we cannot understand this phenomena unless we understand the kind of context in which it happens. Therefore, they are deeply imbricated into the kind of social and economic changes that took place at the end of the Middle Ages. In lectures 2 and 3, I provided a kind of overall, very broad context for the entire course, running from 1000 to 1600. And what I want to do here is precisely to speak about the social and economic developments at the end of the Middle Ages and throughout the 16th century. And we begin where we always begin. We begin, of course, with the rural world, with the peasants. And that is so because by the 1500s, the peasants represented still close to 80% of the entire population of Western Europe. That is to say, it is still, in spite of modernity, a deeply rural world. And witchcraft is essentially a rural activity. We forget sometimes that a great deal of the accusations of witchcraft have to do with rural events, such as the spoiling of milk, the curling of butter, the falling down of a pile of logs, or things like that, kind of inconsequential phenomena which cannot be explained rationally and which is essentially attributed to witchcraft. So in a sense, it is with the rural world that we begin. What is taking place in Europe in the late 15th and early 16th century? One of the things that we know is that, and I have said this so many times that you must be sick of it, that the rural community begins to break down at the end of the 15th century. We saw it already in the demands of the German peasants asking for access to the commons. That is to say that in the Middle Ages, the rural community, the village, had some kind of, should we say, democratic equality. Now, I do not really believe that this was the case, but there is at least some kind of rough equality in the village. If you are a citizen of the village, which has a very specific meaning, that is to say, if you own property in the village, therefore you have access to the commons, and even if your holdings are very small, nonetheless, you have a way of surviving. By the late 15th century, a kind of changes that occurred, the rise of a class society in Europe, led to, in many respects, great social and economic differences within the village community, which meant, essentially, that many peasants lost their lands, and these lands are now in the hands of a few people in the village who control the village. The rich people in the village who have now essentially even began the processes of privatizing the commons. The best and most clear sign of this is, of course, enclosure. That is to say, the fencing of commons, the fencing of lands, the marking of boundaries, in the same manner in which we saw in the previous lecture how mental and cultural boundaries are mapped out in this period, in the same manner it happens in the land. The land is now encircled by fences, it's closed down. What you have as a result of this is, of course, is incredible social dislocation. When we look at Essexshire in England in the 17th century, we are going to see that essentially this is one of the reasons for witch accusations in Essex in the 17th century. Essentially what we have here is an economic and social displacement, together with an increasing population. By some strange circumstances, the population of Europe, which have been fairly stagnant until the end of the 15th century, begins to grow very rapidly. This is due to the introductions of new crops, certain new methods of cultivation, certain technological advances, and so on. And the fact is, of course, that the new population leads to a dramatic increase in the number of the poor. If you read Thomas More's Utopia, a great book which is begins with a kind of, should we say, analysis of the situation, the economic and social situation of England at the beginning of the 16th century, you see that the masses of the poor going from town to town begging, and how they are essentially expelled from certain communities which do not allow begging within the boundaries, how poor houses come into being, and the mistreatment of the poor. I will say here, and I will reiterate it later on, that there is a connection between, or there is a very clear connection between economic standing or economic status, social status, and being accused of being a witch. That is to say, though we have some cases in which the people accused of witchcraft are people in the upper levels of society, nonetheless, the majority of the people who are accused of witchcraft are people who are in a very specific social niche. That, by the way, is also the case in Iberia among those who are accused of being Judaizers. That is to say that they belong to a very specific social class. That is the class caught between the extreme poor and those on top of them, and people who feel squeezed by the economic and social changes. It's not only that poverty has changed dramatically in terms of numbers, that is to say that there are far more poor people in early modern Europe than there was in the Middle Ages, but that the very face of poverty changes as well, and the very attitudes towards poverty also change. What happens in the late Middle Ages and in the early modern period is that poverty becomes the value. That is to say, the kind of Christian's attributes of poverty are now shown aside. This coincides, of course, with new ways of thinking about the economy, with the birth of capitalism, and with the secularization of the world. Now, in the Middle Ages, this is also happening, but it's not happening to the extent that it happens in the late 15th and early 16th century. What we have here is that the poor begins to be seen no longer as, in fact, the child of God, no longer as one who will get the kingdom of heaven, but someone who is essentially outside the boundaries of society, who is marginalized. And there is a great debate that goes on in Europe in the 16th century about how you ought to treat the poor. And the majority of opinion is that the poor has to be confined or forced to work, or indeed seen as malevolent and evil. There is something in his or her character that leads to begging. And in fact, begging becomes an activity which now begins to be monitored. You have to get a license to beg. Unless the king gives you a license to beg, you cannot beg. And begging becomes, in fact, one of the things that is closely associated with witchcraft. And it's very simple. The kind of all formulaic ways in which people beg are becoming under attack. Even to this very day, in third world or so-called third world countries, on less developed worlds, there is still an element of charity and poverty which remains. You come to the door of someone who is well-to-do with your little can asking for food. You will knock at the door and you will say, "A piece of bread for the love of God." It's a formulaic phrase which was used throughout Europe in the Middle Ages and in the early modern period. Now, in traditional societies or in the Middle Ages, you will get perhaps a bit of food, a piece of bread, a coin, alms, and so on. In the late Middle Ages and the early modern period, it is not uncommon for the person to reject you. And since the beggar might be an old person, meaning a woman who doesn't have the wherewithal to live by herself and who is forced to beg, there would be a kind of relationship, a cursing that occurred. You tell the beggar, "Get out of here, get out of my door, you old hack." She will turn back and say to you, "Curse you." Then something happens to you that evening, you go to bed, you try to make love to your wife, cannot happen. Who to blame? Clearly, that old beggar was a witch. So in a sense, what we have here is a social condition that leads to poverty, that leads to begging, that leads to, in a climate which has changed in the attitude towards charity and poverty, which leads to conflict between those who have and those who have not, and to growing distance between those who have and those who have not. There is also, as a result of the wars that we discussed in the previous lecture, as a discuss of all the social changes, there is an imbalance between women and men in early modern Europe. That is to say, there are far more women than they are men. And many of these women are old, they are widows, or they are women who lived on the edge of town and who have very little income. Poverty and age are also contributors to accusations of witchcraft. And therefore, they live in the edge of town. They are people who have certain knowledge and certain lore. They engage in practices of some kind of herbal medicine. They are healers. They know about certain things, not only because of their age, but because it's an activity usually and traditionally associated with women. Now, one of the social changes that occurred in this period is, of course, the rise of the medical profession. And doctors do not like the competition that is provided by these old women who are healers or midwives. It is, again, not a coincidence that a good number of the women who are brought on charges of witchcraft, brought up on charges of witchcraft, are midwives, and that they are accused because of what they do, which is to deliver babies, half of which, in fact, die within a very short time, because that's the rate of mortality in late medieval and early modern Europe, who are accused of having, in fact, killed the babies for their own diabolical practices. So that there is, in some respects, also another social link between the rise of professional societies and professional groups such as doctors, who become essentially an identifiable social entity in the 16th and 17th century, and the attack against certain types of individuals who have engaged in practices which are no longer acceptable by those in power. So in a sense, what we have here is greater controls on how you practice certain things, a distrust of the poor, distrust of all people, and so on. All of this takes place also in the midst of an extraordinary change, which is, of course, a great shift in the mentality of Europe, which is, in fact, signaled by the rise of such institutions of control as the poor house, the prison, the mental asylum. This is, of course, the great work of Michel Foucault, and in many, many of his books, he discussed the process by which Europe, in the early modern period, begins a process of monitoring itself, but it also begins a process of controlling society. This is, of course, most evident in attitude towards madness. Before you are a mad person, you are certainly someone who is close to God. You are, in fact, allowed to circulate in society unless you are dangerous. You could engage in all your eccentricities. By the end of the early modern period, by the end of the witch craze, the mad person will be placed in a confinement, will be in a mental institution, in an asylum, and he will become, or she will become, an object and a spectacle. The great to-do, the classes, the middle classes, the upper elite will come to places like the sanatory at Bethlehem, to examine and to see and to be entertained by the antics of the mad, who is now confined to a very specific institution. The prison system. Of course, there are dungeons and prisons in the Middle Ages, but the idea of a prison as a kind of, so we said, linchpin of the rising estate, as a place where you confine those who are not to be allowed outside the society, is also part of that. Together with that, of course, with these new forms of ordering society, of monitoring society, comes confession. And there is a dramatic change that occurs, which is also, of course, a result of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. How you confess. Before, in the Middle Ages, you will go to the priest and you will confess. You will confess your sin. I have sinned. I have had evil thoughts. In the 16th and 17th century, when we have many manuals of confessions that instruct the priest essentially how to ask questions about what you have done evil, what we have here is essentially a numerical enunciation of sin. That is to say, you are not going to tell me that you had evil thoughts or that you did evil deeds. But you now have to enumerate how many of them. And any of us who is old enough and grew up in a Catholic country remembers of confessions before Vatican Council II, that the priest will always ask you, and how many times? Because essentially what we are entering here is, and this is also, of course, related to the scientific revolution that I discussed in the previous lecture, what we have here is that monitoring devices in which you begin to create categories of sin, categories of behavior, and so on. So essentially what we have here is a world that is changed dramatically, and a world in which people who behave in certain specific forms no longer have a place. And of course, together with that is the rise of capitalism, the discovery of the new world. Think about what capitalism means. And capitalism is born. That is to say, the wish craze is going on. It's another manifestation of the culture of the Baroque, but it is also a concomitant process which emerges out of the development of new ways of conceiving the relationship between man and money. There was always something, shall we say, dangerous about the accumulation of wealth. It is always felt in the Middle Ages where there are people who are exceedingly greedy and who also accumulate immense amounts of wealth, but there was always the feeling, the very wealth sort of founded feeling, that the accumulation of wealth, that the giving yourself to the pursuit of mammon was in fact something that will lead you to hell. That a camel will go first to the eye of the needle, as I have said before in the lecture on St. Francis, then a rich man will enter the kingdom of heaven. And what we are talking about in the 16th century and in the 17th century is the secularization of economics. In the same manner in which art had been secularized in the Renaissance, in the same manner in which politics have been secularized by Machiavelli, in that same manner, capital, money making, the way in which you perceive your relation to the material world is transformed by the early emergence of capitalism in the 16th century and by its consolidation in the 17th century. Because how much money should someone make? As much as possible. Essentially, what we're really talking about here is not the art of making money and large-scale trades and the discovery of a new world and a kind of worldwide circulations of goods. We are talking about the commodification of life, the way in which commodities become exceedingly important. We are talking about social relationships, personal relationships between owner and worker, between those who work for you, and so on. The old medieval world will still linger on and hang on in trade association and craft associations and guilds and so on, but it is now very much under attack by this dramatic, in fact, economic transformation. So, in a sense, capitalism is another one of those factors that adds a great deal of anxiety, because your place in the world, especially for the great mass of peasants who want deeply not to change, because the peasants are exceedingly conservative and fear the great economic and social transformations. They want to retain the old good ways when they broke the back working, but they were not threatened essentially by these dynamic changes that are taking place in European society. And then, of course, think of the anxieties of the new world. Think that you are a peasant. Now, let me give you a very good example of this. Think that you are a peasant in a village along the road that leads from Seville to Barcelona. And there you are, and you have been all your life in this village, and you have never seen anything of the world, and you have been told by your priest umpteen times about the unity of the universe and the universality of Christianity. And suddenly, in 1493, there is this crazy Italian called Christopher Columbus walking along this road or marching along this road with 12 natives from the New World adorned by very sort of flashy plumes. Who are these people? Where do they come from? What is this New World? Were we not told for years and years and years that there was essentially one universe, that Christianity has a spread? Hey, these people have never heard of Christ. These people have never heard of us. Who are these people? The New World produced a tremendous shock on the European imagination because it forced the Europeans to rethink the way the world was, to, in a sense, imagine the world very differently. All the old authorities, all Pliny and John of Mandeville, all those travel literature has to be discarded, because there you have a world that is so different altogether from yours, in which the people are organized in ways that are so different from yours, that it forces the Europeans for the next 150 years to rethink that, to rethink their own world. And that, of course, filters down in the images and that the poor sees, that the peasants hear of about this distant and strange new world where all kinds of bizarre things could take place, where all kinds of buildings that are very different from any European building are. So in a sense, the discovery of the new world, capitalism, also adds to the general anxiety, which we will discuss in detail in the next lecture, the question of fear, the fear of the unknown, the fear of the new, the shock of the new. And then, of course, finally, the rise, the final consolidation of the modern nation state. I want to repeat what I have said many times before, the Weberian phrase, that is to say, that idea that the new state, the new nation, has a legalized monopoly of violence. What we are talking about here is the way in which the rise of the rational state, the rise of the secular state, the one in which sovereignty is well defined, in which is a political activity separate from religion. The state benefits from religion. Religion consolidates the power of the state. But make no mistake about this. Religion, as Philip II have said, is too important to leave it to the Pope. Religion serves here, from the 16th century onwards, a political purpose. It is put, in fact, at the service of the state, and it is deployed for greater means of control. It is deployed as a way, in a sense, to exert authority over all those people who live within your boundaries, who live within a very specific geographical location, who are part of a new community that is now acquire its own identity, an identity which is different altogether from the identity of those who lived across the border. Even two steps across, they are different. We are French, they are English. We are French, they are Germans. We are French, they are Spaniards. That is to say, a world in which each community has its own identity. The rise of the nation state led, as we shall see in the next lecture, to new methods, to new manners of enforcing order, to standing armies, to new concepts of power, to new ways of representing royalty, to new manners in which power is exercised, to new explanations. The peasants, the middling sorts, the people at the bottom who have barely felt the presence of the state in the 14th and early 15th century begin now to feel the effects of that revolution, the revolution that takes place in England at the end of the 15th century. We call it the Tudor Revolution, or the revolution that takes place in France after the end of the Hundred Years' War with the emergence of Louis XI, the spy, the king, or which takes place in Castile under the rule of Isabella, that is to say, the centralization of power. There is hell to pay for the centralizing of power. The nation state will exact a heavy toll on those who, in a sense, will be selected as target for his own new power. And one way in which the power of the state is most made most evident is, of course, the Inquisition. And in this last part of the lecture, I want to turn briefly to the persecutory mechanisms, the use of torture, and the kind of spectacles of power which are presented throughout Europe against witches, against Jews, against people suffering from leprosy, against dissenters, against heretics, in that great processes which leads to the construction of national identities. Now, the Inquisition does not operate in Protestant countries, but where the Inquisition does not operate, there are mechanisms that are similar to the Inquisition. Now, think, for example, that the most noted, the best known Inquisition is, of course, the Spanish Inquisition. And note here that the Spanish Inquisition is, of course, an instrument of the state. That is to say that it does not, in fact, is not under papal supervision, that it is under the control of the crown, and that the crown uses it as a battering ram against dissenters to enforce some kind of national unity. This is very clear, and it has been very clearly proven by historians and so on. But think of the state now, who has hand in hand with religion in the persecution and execution of those who in fact are identified as evil, of being enemies of Christianity, of being consorting with Satan. It is, in a sense, a kind of, shall we say, trying to make things be what they are not. The Inquisition, of course, will never execute anyone. The Church will not execute anyone. They will, and here is the word that is used, they will release the guilty to the hands of the state that will do the killing. The state doesn't want the Church to kill anyone because the state claims that monopoly of violence. They claim the monopoly to execute people. So that, in a sense, what you have is the formation of very elaborate persecutory mechanisms that are going to be used by both Protestants and Catholics in the ferreting out of the enemy. Witches, Jews in Spain, conversos, Muslims practicing some kind of Islamic religion under the guise of Christianity. And then, of course, there is the way in which they are essentially executed. All throughout the continent, burning at the stake. In England, hanging by your neck. Think about the body of the victim. Think about the theatricality, the spectacle of the burning. Think about in a world without television, without newspapers, in which very few people have books. Think about the extraordinary psychological impact of this event. Think about of the mold in D.C., in Washington, D.C., or the great square, where all the people come to, in a sense, be witnesses to this process of punishing the body of that person who had been found guilty. And there is a procession that leads to the execution. Even in a small villages, there is always a small procession. And the people in the procession are arranged hierarchically. That is to say, you have a very clear pedagogical purpose in the way in which you execute people. You are telling all those who are gazing upon the spectacle about the very nature of power in this society. Who comes first? Who comes second? Everyone is compelled to be present at this act. If you don't come in and you're a member of a guild, you have to pay a fine for not being here. And there you put the body of the victim on display. And everyone surrounds it. And by the way, these are incredibly popular events. Everyone comes to this. It's better than television. You can go there and see the great show. But there is something else too. In this moment, in this spectacle, in these theaters of power, you also make sure that the victim is going to, in a sense, perform her or his duty. That she or he will confess to his or her crimes, even if they never took place. That she or he will ask for forgiveness. It is, in fact, an extraordinary moment. Because it is a moment of inclusion. That is to say, it's a moment of the ultimate exclusion. You killed the individual. And then at the same time, you reinsert the body of the victim, of the guilty party, into the body of the community. There is a closure to this. There is a dramatic denouement. There is a great ending here. Because as you are facing the fire, you confess your sins, you ask all of those presents and the church and the king for pardon, to pardon you. You ask for your forgiveness, and there you go into your death. And in dying, you are therefore reinserted into the body of the community. Part of the great tragedy of public executions or executions in any country or something like that, the most recent one, is that the family was left extraordinarily, the execution of MacBeth, the family was left extraordinarily in the air because there was no repentance. If the guilty party is not going to repent, he's not going to be executed in public. If he's executed in public, he's then going to, in a sense, provide a catharsis for all. Thank you.